podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello, welcome along to another episode of My Mate Bought a Toaster. I'm still grinning because I've just finished doing the episode you're about to listen to. And, oh, it was so lovely. This guy is brilliant. Rufus Sewell, I've been pursuing him for ages to come on this podcast. And genuinely, I'll try and keep a bit of it in at the beginning. He had no idea what the show was. And I told him about 1,000 times on our Twitter correspondence. And the first thing I say to him when I'm chatting to him is, he's in LA, I'm here in London. And the first thing I said was, right, I need your login details for your Amazon account. And he went, oh, what? I'm sorry, what? So it was very stressful. Anyway, it was a really fun episode. I really hope you enjoy it. Anyway, the reason I'm mainly jumping in here is to say thank you for all your lovely comments about last week's episode with Susanna Constantine. Obviously, she brought up stuff about her recovery as an alcoholic. And thank you for people who got in touch with us about the show, saying how much they enjoyed it, how encouraging it was when people talk about these things and all the awareness and all that stuff. So basically, a great big hug. Thanks for that. Right, that bit's done. Let's crack on with today's episode. Enjoy. Right, now, listen to me. Are you ready for the awkward bit? I'm going to log into your Amazon. How do you feel about that?
I didn't know about that. What is this? What's the idea?
Okay. I log into your Amazon account. I log into my guest's Amazon account, right? And then I go through it and say, why the hell did you buy this? Why did you buy that? And we talk about, and then we talk about your life, right?
Oh
so it
God.
Is your, yeah, this is what, I explained this. I wish you'd read your messages. I did explain that it's awkward.
This is scary. Oh my God.
Right, hello, welcome along. It's My Mate Bought a Toaster. I am absolutely thrilled to be joined this week by a man who had no idea what he was letting himself in for. Please welcome the fabulous actor Rufus Sewell. Rufus, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm probably a bit too excited, if I'm honest. I'm very well. I'm very well. So now, obviously, Rufus, we speak to you. Where are you right now? You're on the other side of the sea, aren't you?
I'm in Los Angeles. I'm in West Hollywood. Literally just got back from the Dominican Republic yesterday, where I was on a lockdown set for 2 months, which was kind of interesting.
What's the difference between...
This is a set where we were living on a hotel, on a resort, and the entire staff and crew were testing 3 times a week. No one entered, no one left without being locked away in their room until they were cleared. And that's what we did. We basically didn't see anyone else. We weren't allowed to leave the complex. We were able to go to, to the set, which was just one beach.
Yeah.
And that's what we did for 2 months, and it was...
What have you been filming, please? What is the project?
I've been filming an M. Night Shyamalan film called...
Oh, amazing.
Called Old, which obviously I've lobbied to change that title, but, So that's what we've been doing.
It's now going to be called Young at Heart.
Yes, exactly. Still got it.
And will that come out? What? And the thing is with films, it takes ages for them to turn around, doesn't it?
It does. And I don't know what it's going to be like, this time. But I think, the thing about M. Night, I don't know, it took me a long time to know what to call him. Like, do you call him M or M. Night? But Night. It took a long time for Night. He finances everything himself. He produces it. So basically, he's kind of got his little deal sorted with the studio. He already seems to have a release date, which is in June. But I don't know what is what and what even release means anymore.
If the film's called Old, that probably means it's coming out on VHS. But actually, what we say now, Rufus, is we say it drops, mate, actually. You say it's dropping it.
Yes. So I'm going to get up with the lingo that was really cool 5 years ago. Exactly.
That's it. Yeah, that's me. Yeah. All right. Now, listen, talking of 5 years ago, let's head back to the past. Because what we do on this podcast, which of course you'll know because you were completely prepared for this, is I go right back to the beginning of your experience of Amazon. So I'm going to 2001.
Yes.
Okay. 2001, when you were living in Kentish Town.
I was.
Yeah. You were. Oh my God. Rufus, you were living about one street away from me. I was on Osney Crescent.
Oh my God. Yes. Before. I'm informed that Kentish Town is actually quite kind of hip now. At the time.
It's recovered.
I remember. I mean, when I bought there, it was called Kentish Town. I remember when I was selling it, they were calling it Kentish Village and Lower Highgate.
Lower Highgate, yes. Primrose Hill East.
Yes, exactly. I had a really lovely, like it was an old converted piano factory that I had the top half of. Wow. Yes, that's many moons back.
Okay. So young man living in Kentish Town in August 2001. The first thing you buy is Middlemarch from 1994 starring, oh look, Rufus Sewell.
Yes.
So that's good.
Did I? Why did I buy that? What was it? A DVD? What was it?
Yeah, it's a DVD. Oh, look at your curls, love.
I
know.
Lovely curls. I can't think why I would have done that because it's not like I watch my old stuff. Maybe I was forcing it upon some poor fucker. Maybe I was trying to convince someone that I could do serious acting without playing a baddie or something, probably at that stage. Who knows? Certainly wasn't for my own delectation.
No, there's nothing worse than watching yourself back, surely.
No, God, well, it's not everyone is like that. I have known actors who, if you end up, a group of you going back to their place, they'll put on something of theirs.
So awkward.
I have experienced it. And then shush you when it gets to a good bit that they don't want you to miss and rewind it. I have actually experienced this. Like, hold on, you missed a bit. There was, oh no, watch, shh, don't watch this bit. There's a bit, watch. Yeah, it's good. Oh. You know, literally, and I'm talking about a room full of eight people who just wanted to drink, you know.
Name names.
No, I
am
not.
Who was there?
I could not have told you this story if I thought I was going to tell you the name.
Flair, so annoying.
Someone who, in all other ways, quite a nice person, but just, I also can't have pictures of me up, you know.
No, I know.
Like, in Los Angeles, they have a thing with dry cleaners where they have celebrity photographs.
Yes, of course they do, yes.
You know, so what happens is they ask you, if they recognise you, if they can have a picture. But what that means is I can just never go back in there again. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I couldn't frequent a place where there was a picture of me saying, you know, go get them, tiger, or something underneath it, which is obviously what I write underneath my photo.
Rufus Sewell gets his pants cleaned at this dry cleaners. Oh, it's awful. It's awful. So Middlemarch from 94, was that a big moment in the career? Was it breakthrough?
I don't know about that because my career's always kind of had the same pattern that there would be an apparent breakthrough that would then just kind of ebb away. You know, so I've had many attempted mini, I would always say that I have, I've got a boost-proof career.
Yes.
Then basically, occasionally something will happen. But it comes back to a kind of very, very livable median.
Yeah.
But that was one of my first breakthroughs. I got Arcadia and Middlemarch at the same time.
Okay.
And they were both set in the same period, 1815 or so. And because I got them at the same time, we had them over a barrel. Otherwise, if I'd got one first, they would have claimed me. But because I got both at the same time, I was able to do both. And they worked it out so I could go between doing Middlemarch and doing the National, which they did, you know, for a couple of months at a time.
Oh, my
God. So that kind of changed things for me. But I suppose it's as close to a breakthrough as I ever had.
The actors on set must have hated you if you're getting into your car to head down to the Nash every night. Oh!
No, I wasn't quite doing that. Though I did do that once. I did that when I was doing a film called The Woodlanders and Rat in the Skull. I did that at the same time. Mm. And that was... that didn't really work out. I mean, it did with the play.
Yes, it really did with the play.
The play survived.
Yes, the play won awards, yeah. Didn't it?
No, I don't know if it did. I don't know if it did. It was one of the best things I'd ever done, and I don't think it did win awards, which is a very useful thing, a very useful lesson to learn quite early on, is that sometimes your best work does not get noticed, and sometimes work that you know is not your best does. Mm. So I think it all evens out.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. Well, that's why I do podcasts, definitely for the former, not the latter of those two. listen to this. This is, now the humiliation begins. Now I see why you were nervous about me doing this. 2nd of December 2001, yes. You know, we're weeks after 9/11, the world's on its knees, and you go for comfort and entertainment by buying, you spent £20 on this, Jeremy Clarkson, top 100 cars.
Yes, there was a stage when I was obsessed with classic cars. This is, oh my goodness, I remember. Yes, what a different world. So yes, there was a point when I was into stuff like that. I was also into, I mean, Jesus, in terms of spending, I used to waste my money on such bollocks. I was like really into audiophile quality stereos.
Oh, that's bollocks. That is bollocks.
Shit like that. And yeah, and also just kind of looking at not things like Ferraris and stuff like that, but like kind of really rare, weird British classic cars, like things like the Gordon Keeble. And I drove a Bristol, which I still loved that car. Mm. But yes, that's really, really embarrassing, but quite accurate. That was the thing that I was into. I mean, it didn't often stoop as low as that. I mean, you know, I'd run out of all the classic car books, which were embarrassing enough before I got to that. Even.
I'm trying to work out what's more embarrassing, bringing people back to your flat to make them watch you or looking at your classic car DVD with Jeremy Clarkson. I can't quite work it out. But all I know is that I'm now imagining you as the sort of the Bergerac of Kentish Town in 2001 with your classic car.
Oh my God, it's so, yes, exactly.
But how old, well, I mean, I wouldn't want to pry about your age, because obviously all actors are roughly 25. But when you,
I'm 53.
Thank you.
I've just turned 53.
Good. So 2001, you are however old you are, 30, with, you know, classic cars and all that sort of stuff. That's a reasonable sort of, it's quite premature midlife crisis territory there.
Yeah, definitely. You could look at it that way. I've had probably on about my fifth midlife crisis now, but at the time it was, I think it was about trying to work out what to do with money that I had never really planned on getting. So when I must add another thing that I'd only just learned to drive at this point.
Oh, wow.
I actually couldn't drive till I was about 30.
That's late. Why so late?
Because I couldn't be bothered. I mean, I don't know why. I mean, my dad was the same. I would get taxis or the tube or walk. I always, you know, and then I learned to drive very late. I learned to drive in Australia, actually, when I was doing Dark City.
Okay.
My first driving lesson, actually, here's a bit of trivia for you, was with Kiefer Sutherland, who took me driving around the film set and outside.
What? What is happening?
Yep, that's
what
true.
Your first...
And then my...
Oh my God, this is...
Yeah, that was my first time I ever...
Don't you dare move on from that. Your first driving lesson was with Jack Bauer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
How
come? No, there's only one time before that I ever drove. Mm. And that was, I did a film called A Man of No Importance with Albert Finney playing a bus conductor in Dublin who's convinced he's, who fantasizes that he's Oscar Wilde. And I was his bus driver, who was Bosie. And I arrived in Ireland and someone called me, I think it was a second AD, and said, Roy Rufus, someone's going to be picking you up at like 9 a.m. to take you for your bus driving lesson. Are you familiar with driving a bus? Because we're going to take you down to the bus depot and your man's going to take you through the, you know, procedure. And that was my chance to say, I can't drive. But I said, familiar with driving a bus? No. Right, that's what I said. And then I put the phone down and I'm just... So they picked me up and they took me to the bus depot. And this man said, I've heard you've not driven a bus before. And I went, no. He said, so it's pretty much like a normal car, first gear set. And I said, right. Yeah. Could you... And I was literally sitting behind the steering wheel at this point. I said, could you just run that? I mean, obviously, just so I can show me through the gears again. And this is the clutch. So, right. And I went for a drive. And that was the first time I'd ever driven. The second time I drove was in Dublin when they were filming in a town square. And this is like, talk about actor's nightmare. I just didn't tell anyone I couldn't drive.
Oh, my God.
And I my second time driving was on camera, driving Albert Finney on a bus with a rig, with a lighting rig on the side of the bus. And there is, I don't know if they replaced the lamppost that I knocked down, but it did happen.
No, did you actually crash?
Yeah. And then, but my first actual, I didn't crash, but I knocked over a lamppost. And then my third time, my actual driving lesson was when Kiefer stepped in to save the day.
So, a question I've never asked before, but, you know, there's a first for everything, especially on this podcast. What is Kiefer Sutherland like as a driving instructor?
Very calm, he was very nurturing. he said he couldn't believe that I couldn't drive. And we stepped out of the makeup trailer. We got in his Holden, which is an Australian car.
Yeah.
And he took me out of the showgrounds, which is now Warner in Sydney. And I went for a drive.
With Kiefer Sutherland. And
with Kiefer Sutherland telling me what to do.
And the rest is history. That is amazing. I mean, I feel like wrapping up the podcast there. That's got to be, that's the best.
Sometimes you gotta spice up your life in the bedroom. How about you go online and buy a sexy costume? Love it at this age doesn't have to be doom and gloom. Oh, it's time you felt so fine, you buy a sexy costume.
9 orders now in 2005. Uta Hagen's acting class. Finally, you're getting some acting lessons.
Oh, that's what it's called. This is actually really useful because that is such a brilliant DVD. Because I you know, went to an English drama school, but I was always obsessed with method acting. And, you know, one of the places that I wanted to go to was East 15. I didn't even know about the Drama Centre until I'd got into Central. But I'd always, even though I went to a kind of, you know, more or less down the middle kind of drama school, I was one of the actors that was kind of really obsessively trying to work out the method on my own. And Uta Hagen's video is such a brilliant, practical... I'd like to get that again now I've been reminded what it's called.
Oh, well, listen, I can simply click on buy it again, but it might go to a previous house, so I won't do that.
She says really brilliant, useful things. Like, she says to an actor, because it's like a class and it's video, she said, people never stand up when they can sit down. What a brilliant thing to hear. What wonderful permission to have.
God,
you know, because you see all these actors, especially young actors at drama school, standing there frozen with their arms swinging so they can look open and present. And only actors do that.
Yes, you know? People do that in real life. Are you sitting down now? I'm sitting down now.
Of course. Yeah. And really, you know, in real life, if there was a chair, you'd fucking sit on it, wouldn't you?
Yes.
You wouldn't stand there swinging your arms to show that your perineum's open.
Yeah, you should go in. You should be in a really aggressive director. You'd be a great pissed off director. Sit the fuck down.
Exactly.
So Uta Hagen, so she's all about the method. And do you actually still do that? And obviously all actors say they're constantly learning and all that sort of stuff.
No, I wouldn't say that. I'd say that, you know, in my experience, when I've worked with my heroes, they work in a similar way. They read it a lot. They try to relax and have a nice time. And the rest is just secret. It's just what they do, you know? And I think most good actors, you know, when Stanislavski was writing his theory, he said, this isn't what the great actors do. The great actors just do it naturally. And this is the system for when it doesn't happen naturally.
Yes. Yes. Good.
Which is a really great thing to hear, because all these people straining away. I've worked with people who call themselves method actors, and I've worked with people who, you know, say that they don't believe in all that. And the only difference between them is the good ones and the bad ones. You can't tell from what they say their method is at all.
I mean, we worked together very fleetingly on Victoria, and just there's an atmosphere and a vibe on set, and the lead actors on set create the atmosphere of the set. And luckily all my scenes were with you. And it just meant everyone was like, guys, there's this sense of, this is fun. This is fun, isn't it? This is fun. That's all it is.
It was so much fun. We had such a lovely time. Well, but that's the thing. I just worked with Olivia Colman and Anthony Hopkins. I just did a film with them.
Yeah.
And it was the same. I had to remind myself that I was working with, you know, my favorite actors and my hero when I went home, because it just felt you were having a nice time with some rather good actors and hearing some lovely stories, which would be interrupted by him popping off and getting a fucking Oscar. And then he'd get his Oscar and he'd come back and he'd finish his anecdote, you know, and he was telling me his, I mean, it was, because he was saying, oh, I lived in Los Angeles for a while. And I remember I wasn't, you know, my manager was telling me to go out and see more people. And, you know, because I wasn't getting work, which I was thinking, oh, that's good. That makes me feel so much better.
Yes.
And he said, well, eventually I did get a job. And I said, what was that? He said, the Elephant Man. I went, oh, fuck off. The elephant. Oh, really? That was the little gig. Okay. I was feeling so kind of, you're like me, aren't you? We're the same. No. Okay. It's a little reminder.
It is a tremendous comfort when you hear people like that say, well, I wasn't getting any work, but that's a terrible ending. That's a sting in the tail there. I think about you when I'm without you. I think about you. Please don't believe me.
Hello, my name's Beth Murray, and if you'd like to hear funny people talk about giving birth, then have I got the podcast for you.
Poor Richard, he made the schoolboy error of standing up to see the baby while I was on the operating table, and I think that's really not recommended.
You were scarred for life, he was scarred for life. In the latest series of One Torn Every Minute, a whole labour ward of new guests tell me their birth stories in hilarious and graphic detail.
Gas and air can suck my...
That's One Torn Every Minute. Available now on all good podcast platforms.
I suppose you wouldn't do it at all, would you, if you really thought about it?
When they're looking through your shopping history and they don't understand it, you have been bought red-handed.
2008, one order placed in the whole year. This makes my job very easy when there's only one item a year, by the way. Thank you for that.
It depends what it is.
Exactly. Here we go. Good luck. Strap in or strap on. 17th of March 2008, you bought the Fun Table football game, the only thing you bought all year. Do you remember buying that?
Yes, I bought that for my son.
Nice. Okay.
And I bought that for my son in a year when I wasn't able to see him so much because I was working in another country and he was with my ex. So now I look back on that and think, in terms of my ex and her new fella, what a fucking wanker's thing to do. I meant it in the nicest way, but now I look back at it and think, they were actually really decent not to say, what are we going to do with this, you prick? Because it's huge. It's like if I'd had the kind of brain that thinks these things, it would be a perfect passive-aggressive fuck you. But I didn't mean it that way at all. I realised that I bought that, because they still have it. It's like a full-on...
size of an actual football pitch.
It's like actually a kind of aggressive present, I now realise, because it takes up a lot of room and I'm really embarrassed. But I didn't mean it that way at all.
It's up there with the drum kit. That's got to be the disaster.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That must have been hard. That must have been very tricky to be not only split up, but also on the other side of the world working. That can't be easy.
No, it was. It was very hard. But I decided then, and it's been pretty much my policy since then, though it's less necessary now because of the age he is and because of the amount of work that I did in England once I came here, was that any money that I would save, I would spend on flights back and forth.
Yes.
And also I wouldn't waste my time with business class or anything stupid like that, but just get, you know, because when you're flown, sometimes you're flown in quite a flashy way. And it's very important, I think, not to get used to that because it screws with your priorities. Because, you know, I could fly five times coach, as long as you have something to read, for the price of a fancy business class ticket. Yeah. So I would fly back and forth as much as I could.
I see what you're saying, but that's because you're a short ass. When you're 6'3", it's a fucking nightmare.
Yes, exactly.
That's the problem.
No, I do. I know I do get it. But I have worked out ways where you can get the bulkhead seats and stuff like that. There are ways around that.
All right, okay, good. The tricks of the trade.
No, I wouldn't want to be you. No, it's right. True. I wouldn't want to be you.
The worst one I ever had was touring with Stephen Merchant and watching him have to fold himself onto a plane. We did a tour in the Scandinavia and we got 23 flights and every single one he wept.
Oh my God.
Look, here we are, 2009. We're coming back to the topic of your mum, I believe, who we touched upon. Joe, this is your mum. You bought her Ottolenghi the Cookbook, 3rd of November, 2009.
Yes. Because I just had it because I, the kind of, when I went to Ottolenghi, it reminded me of the kind of things that she would occasionally dream up when we were young. We were quite poor, and my dad wasn't with us. You know, I was on like free school meals. So we were, you know, properly poor, but at the same time, kind of middle class because it's so weird the way these things are judged because we had a piano and we had books. In many ways, we were quite privileged, but we didn't have any money.
Right. So you just have to eat the books.
Yeah, exactly. Well, my mum had a vegetable round. She had a black London cab, which was her car, and she'd taken the taxi light off, and she would fill that full of vegetables that she'd hoodwink out the Barrow boys at Kew Markets, and she would sell what was not rotten and what was left to a little collection of friends of hers, and we would live on what was left.
Wow.
And so we would eat some very exotic things. Strangely enough, like one week it would be nothing but like, you know, artichokes and pomegranates and whatever. But it just really reminded me of my mum's cooking. I just knew that she'd love that, even though it's not the kind of place she would ever countenance paying for. Mm. You know, she would, before she saw the prices at Ottolenghi, there's, you know, this is someone who travels 5 miles on a bus to get 1 pence off a can of peas, you know.
Yes.
So Ottolenghi just really, really reminded me of the food that I, you know, ate growing up.
That surprises me about your upbringing because there's this impression, isn't there? I think people perceive you as being one of the sort of Cambridge poshos who has had all sorts of privilege, and that's, as you've been describing, not the case at all, is it?
Well, no. I mean, it's just one of the things about casting, you know, that actually it can be a little frustrating because it's like, I really There's no roles that I play that I don't like playing. But the idea that it's kind of like, if you get them right, you know, sometimes the only problem I'll have with a role is that if I get it really right, it might confirm a prejudice about the type of actor I am, you know, because actually I can play all kinds of things. But over the years, I've just tried to stop worrying about that. And it doesn't really matter as long as I work, to tell you the truth.
Really, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And also, you get to do this with that background and with your mum, you know, a single parent on the breadlines you've described. How good must it feel for you now to be in this position and to have your mum see you have the success you've got?
Oh, it's lovely. But I think my mum isn't so concerned with the success I've got out in the world, so to speak, as just as long as I'm happy. You know, if anyone ever asked my mum if she was proud of me, she'd say, I'm proud of both my boys. You know, and I like that about her, that yes, she's proud of me, but I think she's always been more concerned with, you know, if I'm okay or not. And there's been times when I've been doing very well, you know, seemingly on the outside, and it hasn't been such plain sailing, and I think that's the thing that takes up her attention, you know. I'm glad to say.
Yes, yeah, you know? Yeah, that is good. 9th of March again, bought for your mum here, Zen Omnibus Rat King Vendetta Cabal. So this is, I believe you know about the in-joke. I've been meaning to tell you about this for months. There's an in-joke in the Sunday Times. Do you know about this?
No.
So the Sunday Times, in the culture section, they have letters from people, and it's letters specifically about TV. And there is a niche in-joke every week.
Bring back Zen.
Rufus, I'm not joking. Every week, someone gets a letter in saying, bring back Zen. I've been meaning to say this for ages. Yeah. It's up, and it makes every weekend, I go looking for it.
It would make me laugh too.
Good.
I get that. People come up to me. I love it. It's just the way people think things work. People come up to me and say, you know what you should bring back? That's Zen. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'll have a think about that.
You know. See, done. Yeah, yeah. It's a lot like, if you do an advert, you do a voiceover for something. Oh, did you get loads of free mayonnaise? And no, they gave me money. That's not how it works.
Well, can I tell you, there's something about taking a pay cut to be in a film that turns out to be terrible just because you're desperate to work, and people say, I hope you got paid well for that, mate. Because the terrible truth is, no, I actually didn't.
This does happen. You do hear about this. What was the movie a couple of years ago? The Quentin Tarantino film, the Nazi German thing. Oh, I forgot what it's called.
Inglourious Basterds.
Apparently none of them got paid for that. Is that true, or is that just an urban myth?
I don't know, but I do know that, you know, it's quite possible that I know that if I was to be offered something with a director who I revere, it wouldn't surprise me to hear, no one's really getting paid for this, darling, you know, is the kind of thing you hear. And in my experience, you know, when I've done films that have turned out to be, that I've done just praying that they'll turn out okay because I need to work and I haven't, you know, often, you know, the films that will come out will certainly appear to look commercial, you know. But for me, I always did those films, I think, unwise. I've now realised it doesn't work. But on advice, to try to trick myself to be able to smuggle my way into the small kind of quiet indie films that I always wanted to do. And people would say, oh, well, this will help. It never does.
Does it, you know? Does it feel, no, that the idea of, well, that part must have opened a few doors for you, certainly in my great experience. Yeah. I've never had that. But does it feel different when you're on an indie film and people are doing it for passion? Is it a more enjoyable experience than a big commercial blockbuster?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if I had the chance to only do the, I mean, to tell you the truth, if I could just do small English films, that's all I'd do. Mm. You know, I ended up in America because for a while those didn't come my way. In fact, they've only really started to now. And strangely enough, you know, talking about you do get what you want, just not necessarily when you want it, the last three significant jobs that I've done have come from the same theatre job I did like 15 years ago.
No way. Which one?
Rock and Roll, Tom Stoppard. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel came from that.
Yes.
The Father came from that. And Judy, to a certain extent, came from, you know, my theatre work too. So it doesn't, as long as it happens eventually, you know. So those kind of, I know Judy isn't a particularly small film, but that kind of level of British-made film is the kind of thing I always wanted to do.
And is it because casting directors see you in that, or you get to know directors? How does it work exactly?
See you in what?
Well, when you're doing the play, the Tom Stopper play, this is obviously what I'm doing here is taking notes, trying to work out how to fix my fucking career. But is it because you get seen by casting directors or because of reviews?
No.
Or
No, it's because you get seen by teenagers who go on to become playwrights. That's literally what it is. With, you know, Florian Zeller, who did The Father, saw me. I was the first English language play he ever saw. And that's why he thought of me for this role in The Father. I mean, it's literally been like 15, 17 years. So it's kind of extraordinary, that.
Oh, my God.
I'm not sure that would have... Yeah.
I'm going to go and do some theatre and education.
No, it's true. That's why it is worth it. Just keep doing stuff. I say it first as a joke, but it's totally true that the things that you want do come your way, just not on your schedule.
Mm, good, good. Just ask the universe, just not in that weird Noel Edmonds way. Okay, fine.
Yeah. Where we're going, we'll be showing that we listen to toast. Cause these lovely ass people gonna talk to the host.
He's gonna ask a couple questions.
What they're buying the most. Cause one man goddamn just like a piece of toast.
Now, 2012, look, we said earlier on when you bought your son the fuzzball table, 2012, 17th of March, you've bought him a digital drum machine. Thanks!
Yes, but that's something you could plug into headphones.
That is reasonable. That's okay, fine. Yes, good. Under Milkwood by Stan Tracy, 2nd of February.
Yes, that was part of my growing up, that record, and I had to rediscover it. Because Under Milkwood... especially Under Milkwood, but Dylan Thomas in general is a very big part of my upbringing, because my mum is and was a great lover of Dylan Thomas. We lived for a long time, and my mother lived until very recently in the Pelican in Larn, which is yes. Dylan Thomas's parents' house. Because basically, my mum sold up and moved to Wales at a certain point.
Mm.
And we would... you know, kind of survive as best we could back in London and just go back and forth. So Larn was like our second home. And my dad arrived in England in 1953 looking for Dylan Thomas, and apparently arrived when Dylan Thomas was busy dying in New York. But and he would go to the French house, which was Dylan's old. So that was a very big part of my growing up.
So your dad was a massive Dylan Thomas fan. How do you mean, was looking for him?
Well, I don't know. This is just I think it was part of the attraction of him wanting to come to England because he came from Australia. I've only heard this in passing because there's a lot of stuff that's just tidbits from people that I get about my dad. I mean, there's a lot that of personal experience, but there's stuff about his past. Mm. And, you know, because my dad was much older than my mum, so I didn't know about him as a young man. So now, because I knew that he'd been a wrestler and a bodybuilder and that he'd spent his childhood in hospital. I don't know what the disease was. My mum knows that he missed out on his education. He had some kind of bone disease and they thought he was going to die, but he came out of hospital after years of basically being in hospital, having wasted away and couldn't read or write. And apparently he taught himself to read and write and became a bodybuilder and then a wrestler. So my dad always had these scars on his legs, but he was huge. I mean, it had gone slightly to pot by the time I knew. He had a lovely big belly and he was covered in tattoos and he was an artist. But my dad was this... you know, fabled when we were young because being strong is so important. And our dad used to be a wrestler. And only recently, through my half-sister and through who we hadn't seen for many years, started to get all these photographs of him as a young man and discovered that he sang in a blues band and that these photographs of him doing these bodybuilding competitions. It's really extraordinary to kind of, at my age, my dad was my age when he died.
Wow.
You know, which... it's really something.
Yes, yes. So are you now older than your dad was? Have you got past his age?
No, actually what's really useful in terms of the kind of black spot thing is that my dad fibbed about his age. We don't know if he was 53, 56 or 51 when he died. So there isn't some terrible significant age that I'm coming to. I may have already passed it.
Right.
So that's good when you're But it's good not to be too conscious of a thing like that.
How fascinating that! So you've got the showman and
isn't it?
And the poetry in your blood, Rufus.
Well, when I discovered things like that, it was because I didn't know that about him. I always thought that the musical thing came from my mum. But so there's photographs of my dad singing in a band. Have you just been trying to work out what it all means? It's extraordinary. Like, there's no context.
How did they come to light? Through your half sister?
Through his from the collection of his first English wife, because he was married three times. First English wife, who died recently, whose daughter, Mia, who we're back in contact with, who's gorgeous and a little older than my brother.
Fantastic.
This trove of his old paintings, which are wonderful, kind of Lowry-esque kind of paintings, and photographs of this young man that I'd never even, you know, visualized before. This, like, bodybuilding kind of very, very strange. But to get my age is kind of fascinating.
Yes, it really is. And does it give you, how does it make you feel? Does it give you sort of quite a lot of peace to know? Because you must have asked yourself so many questions about him.
Oh, it's lovely. Yeah, and I'm quite at home with a little bit of mystery. I mean, but to a certain extent, sometimes finding out truths is a little bit disappointing. Like, you know, because I never knew what my dad's family background was. As an actor, people said, oh, you look quite Middle Eastern, do you have any Persian in you? I could say, it's possible, you know. And I quite liked the fact that it was an open book. And then I discovered, having for years believed that my dad, that I was descended from a highwayman called George Sewell, which is obviously what you want to believe.
Yes.
Because there's this story that George Sewell, and my brother still says this is true, George Sewell was deported in the 1830s or so for stealing alcohol on a Sabbath from his neighbour, Mr. Birtwistle.
Oh, well, quite right. Off to Australia with you.
Oh, it's funny because we had a neighbour called our neighbours were the Birtwistles, Toby Birtwistle and Silas Birtwistle. It was all odd names in our street, weird. Except for poor old John West. We stuck in the middle of it. It was honestly Timothy Bilbo, Silas Birtwistle, Toby Birtwistle, Adam Birtwistle, Rufus Casper, and John West.
Did Charles Dickens write your history? That's ridiculous.
It does sound like I should be wearing cravats.
So hang on. There's a family myth that your great great grandfather, whatever it was basically not long after the Toll Poddle Martyrs, naffed off to Australia. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. I think now that may be bollocks. because I'd heard that actually his, like, grandfather came from the Isle of Dogs. I was like, oh, well, that's not quite as exotic as I'd, you know. One is curious to find out the truth, but I have a feeling that rather than what happens in that documentary, rather than find out how fascinating it is, that it will be a journey of finding out how mundane it is.
Yeah.
But there's some happiness there, I've discovered. Actually, embracing your inner mundanity is the key.
Yes, absolutely it is too, right? And this Amazon purchase history is giving that away. You know, here's the mundanity of the Amazon Fire TV stick. Absolute yawnathon. Lovely stuff.
Oh,
and then also
a gift to my mother.
There you go. I can see that. Yes, £35, Mum. Don't pay me back. Look at this. Yeah. Topic hair building fiber.
Topic hair
thing. We love pouring metal filings on the bald spot. Very nice.
Very
good. We've got
very handy in a spot.
Well, yes, isn't it just? As long as the spot stays a spot, that's the problem.
Yes. Exactly. I have discovered recently that not recently, but a while ago. To avoid stylists, if you do a junket or if you do, premieres and stuff, they say, would you like a stylist? And my thing has always been to say, oh, yeah, what? Yeah, okay. But the last few times I've done one, I went to the premiere of a film that I was in and I realised the fact that I looked like a kind of 1970s pantomime, 1970s ventriloquist puppet.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of rosy cheeked, who is that one? Lord, whatever. I just looked so desperate. I've decided to if I'm going to do any of that, do it myself.
Well, but apparently nowadays on set, they don't, friends of mine who are acting at the moment say there's no makeup artists. You have to do your own makeup to keep the makeup artists away for you because of COVID. So,
yes. You know. Yeah, well, I think most actors, especially anyone who went to school in the 80s, the only problem would be to stop me from over-glamming.
this is not about David Bowie, this film. Rufus, please step up. So look, 2017, we've got, there we go, Regain. We've had this a lot before here on My Mate Bought a Toaster. Yeah. Doesn't work. Absolutely doesn't work.
It doesn't. I gave up with that.
But you've still got a full head of hair. You're doing very well. You haven't had the old thatch, have you?
Not as yet.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
But
it does work. They do look good.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Okay.
Never say never.
Okay, fine. All right, good.
But with things like that, my attitude is, it's just like being grey and with wrinkles and stuff. I think I'd rather, because the people who have had it done, well, definitely with the surgery, not that I'd want to anyway, it just, you look so sad.
I know.
Better to, you know, it's just, you see them around a lot in the gyms here, the slightly puffy kind of filled out looking face. Also the fact it looks also a little bit like late stage cirrhosis, but that kind of slightly puffy look.
Yes. I mean,
it's like,
yes,
I know I don't like my wrinkles, but if they were gone, it would look really super, because you don't look younger. You just look like a certain type of person.
I think wrinkles are absolutely fine. I don't like going on, my hair's thin.
I like
really
my wrinkles.
I love your wrinkles. My son points out new wrinkles to me now. He goes, "Daddy, look, that's new." And he's looking on the side of my eyes. Thanks.
No, so is my daughter. My daughter grabs mine. But I like, I mean, also, it's a matter of luck where they turn up. I've got a few new ones that I'm not altogether pleased with their placement.
Okay.
But, you know,
all right. Okay.
What are you going to do?
Fine. Well, exactly. Who cares? And this is interesting. And I think I know why you're getting this one. 10th of January, 2017, Albert Speer, His Battle with Truth by Gita Sereny, which is actually a book I've read. Fascinating.
Yes.
Book about Hitler's architect.
It's extraordinary.
But now, was this bought in advance of the big job that you got in the last couple of years?
Yes, but it was also bought after I brought Albert Speer's Inside the Third Reich, which I read. So I read his version first, which is very, compelling, brilliant study in how people, manufacture a narrative for themselves.
Yes, isn't it just the words, "it wasn't me," again and again and again?
Yes, exactly. And he's constructed something that I think he managed to, like a great salesman, he convinced himself in the quality of his product.
Yes.
I started by reading Albert Speer's Inside the Third Reich, because there's a perspective of someone who was actually there, who was, who actually still told themselves and told everyone that they didn't know, that they didn't know the extent of what was going on. Because I was interested in that level of denial and what happened to people who otherwise might consider themselves to be good people. Because I was playing a character that wasn't in the original book. So that's what I did. I studied as much as possible to try to find out how someone can think they're okay and do that. Then you read her book and Gita Sereny, because what you get when you read Albert Speer's book is a relatively convincing, you're not sure if you believe him, but you could, that he actually didn't know certain things and I read it thinking, God, is it really possible to be that close to the center and not know? Wow. Mm. And then you read her book and realize that even the truth, that version that he convinced himself, was actually also just a lie.
Yes.
That the point when he said he wasn't there, he knew. And the entire constructed tapestry that he built the future of his life on in denial was just lies.
And this is the thing about Albert Speer, is that he was one of the few high up Nazis who wasn't killed. He went to prison, didn't he, for a bit? But he got away with it, basically.
20 years. Yeah, 20 years. He got away with it. But also he was despised by the other Nazis who were with him because they all still, but for his betrayal of Hitler. And, a lot of those old Nazis just went to their graves, and also a lot of the believers still worshipping Hitler and thinking that it was a great betrayal.
Yes, went to their graves, or Argentina, which is a whole different movie.
Yes, exactly.
So, let's talk about The Man in the High Castle. What a fantastic series. And is that now sadly RIP, that show?
Oh, yes. No, that finished a while ago.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, and the fourth season was the last season, yeah.
Okay.
It's all done.
Right, fine. All right. Did you enjoy playing a Nazi, be honest?
Well, I like the clothes, but... The funny thing is that the power of that costume, you're very aware of it when you first put it on.
Yeah.
And then pretty quickly it just becomes clothes. That's an object lesson in what happens to realities, isn't it? That today's nightmare is tomorrow's accepted reality. And no, I was really, really, it found it really fascinating to play someone who otherwise would have been a decent person who'd been corrupted. It was really, really fascinating. And towards the end, I got to play the other version of it, the one that, the one in our timeline.
Right.
And he was a salesman and a good guy.
Yeah.
Because we all have it all in us, as we see right now.
Absolutely. Well, we'll get on to that, because we're nearly at the end of this, Rufus. My God, this has been brilliant. What I love there is the banality of evil in terms of putting clothes on, because you start with this uniform of power and then within days you're just used to it, and that's how it works, isn't it? That's how it happens.
Yes, no, exactly. I mean, I became swastika blind by the end of the job.
I could so clip that sentence out and get you in a lot of trouble.
But to a normal person in a normal set of circumstances, I say normal advisedly, that if you were to see a swastika somewhere, it would arrest your attention and affect you emotionally.
Yeah.
I towards the end, in order to carry on with my job, had to turn that into, it became beige for me.
Yes.
That's what beige looked like on that job. Yes. It was, you know, a very, very difficult job to steal props from, because you'd steal something, thinking, oh, that's nice, nice letter heading. And you'd get home. And then when the fever, the fever dream had worn off, you'd realize you had a Nazi, you know, there's and because these things were made in such incredible detail, the cornflakes had Nazi emblems on them. And, you know, there was nothing that didn't have the iconography stamped through it, like Brighton Rock, you know. Mm. So in order to just play a scene like you were a dad and not be doing Nazi acting, you had to become blind to those things. And that's what people do.
Gosh, that is so true. It's so true. And look, here we are at the end, 3rd of September 2019. And 2020, very quiet year, by the way. You obviously haven't been drilling your Amazon over lockdown. All you've bought in 2020 is the Manhattan Toy Tree, which is lovely. Mm-hmm. Nice. An activity play centre for the kids. 2019, though, this is one I want to finish on because it feels appropriate. Obviously, we've got the Maybelline brow tattoo, clearly. Someone's been penciling in the brows. Sure, maybe it's Maybelline. Maybe
that was a terrible mistake.
Maybe he's born with it. Maybe he's now in his 50s. Go over it. but this is interesting. 3rd of September 2019, proof of conspiracy, how Trump's international collusion is threatening American democracy. We can now enjoy this as history, can't we?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. I literally came back from my job yesterday having, you know, found out finally the news on set, and it rippled through the set like a fire. It was really quite emotional. The realization of what you've been holding on to this for the last 4 years, what this has been for people.
I know.
I mean, it's going to be messy for a while, but my God.
It was interesting, the scenes.
So to come back to America, you know, I was so horrified of having to get on a plane to come back here, because I live here for my daughter. You know, I split up with her mom coming up for 6 years ago. We're amicable, you know, and I have my girlfriend half the time, but I can't ask my ex to move to England. So the reason I've made my peace living in Los Angeles, it's a perfectly nice place to live, and I work where I work, you know, but I am here for my daughter. So it's not like I could leave or would countenance leaving, but the idea of having to come back to 4 more years.
That would push you. That would push you, wouldn't it?
Oh, it was depressing me so much. But so it's been a very happy couple of days.
It's amazing though, seeing the footage. People, someone said, one news pundit said, it's like a regime change. It's not a change in a president. It's a regime change.
Yes, but a regime change that's being celebrated across the world.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That's extraordinary. Yeah. It's not like a normal election result.
No.
So yes, I mean, coming home on the plane, day before, coming home on the plane yesterday, it was just a really wonderful feeling, especially taking into account what the feeling would have been otherwise, which I've been subliminally dreading the whole time I was away, I think.
Yeah, pushing it right down. I know, completely agree. That moment when it looked like Trump might have won, felt like, oh God, I really am depressed about this.
I literally said to my girlfriend, because, you know, there was a few hours different before I went to bed, I was trying to stay up and I had an early start. I called her and I said, I think it's happened again. And she said, I know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I had to go to sleep because I was being picked up 3 hours later and I'd been up all night. And it just, but then something changed and I stayed up another 2 hours. And the same thing that had happened 4 years ago, when I actually had to go to rehearsal of Art, having been up all night. And remember going out on the street and thinking people look normal, like they don't know. It's like there's something comforting about watching adverts after something as terrible happened, because they're evidence of a world before we knew,
yes,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember just walking out on the street and just trying to see if people looked different, because I hadn't slept and I was in shock. So that moment came and went, and then it started to come back in the other direction. So I did manage to go to sleep a bit more hopeful.
It's a horrible feeling, isn't it? Well, listen, it's nice to end. Well, it's nice that the world's ending on a positive note, first of all. It is still very much ending, but at least Biden's there, so that's nice.
Yes, exactly.
But also ending the podcast on a positive note. Rufus, I cannot thank you enough. You've shared so much, and I can tell you now, logged out of your Amazon account with some sadness, because I was very happy in there.
Good. It's been fun.
Rufus Sewell, you're a superstar. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. So lovely to talk to you.
There you go. Now you know absolutely loads about Rufus Sewell that possibly you didn't know before. Absolutely love that man. And he really is. He's one of our best actors. And I think, I feel, in a way, I wouldn't say this to him, you know, when I was actually doing the interview. I feel like he's underrated, and he shouldn't be, because he's brilliant and he's a joy to spend time on set with as well. Brilliant. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I definitely did. As ever, if you could, give us a follow, give us a rate, give us a review, give us a hug, in that order. I'll be back next week. Bye. I love the pretty baby, I don't want you for the rest of my day.
GreatBigOwl.com.
Oh, hello you. My name's Tom Price.
Hello, I'm Dave Cribb.
You should come and join us. Every day we do a podcast called Cabin Fever, where we talk to loads of comedians who've had to cancel everything else in their lives, so they come on our podcast instead, don't they, Dave?
Yeah, it's an isolation podcast.
Dave, were you yawning at the start of that sentence then? Was it just a little yawn?
Yeah, it's basically the Great Big Owl isolation podcast. We'll have people on from all our podcasts, from your Rule of Threes, your Brian Rogers, your Musicals, your Bitchins. If you like any of our podcasts, if you like any of those people, chances are they'll be logging onto the Zoom call and just chatting, because let's face it, they got nothing else to do.
Also, there'll be a quiz on the bill. All right, see you soon. Lots of love. Cabin FE 83709. Oh, that's our Twitter name.